I'm making a request, not to a government agency, but to a website. Here's what I asked them for. Here's the document that they gave me. And here's what I did with that document, right? So I just see building on traditional journalism, right? Just at a scale and using a different kind of language of doing so. But I think it all kind of goes back to the fundamentals.
You're listening to the In Old News podcast, where we interview journalists about how they do their work. I'm Manal Versho.
And I'm Sanchib Biswas. In this episode, we are bringing you an interview with Leon Yin, an investigative data journalist recognized for his work on how technology impacts society. He worked on the investigation that uncovered how Google doesn't allow advertisers to use racial justice terms like Black Lives Matter while allowing the term White Lives Matter.
Another investigation that found Facebook hasn't been transparent about the popularity of right-wing content on its platform. And he worked on a project which uncovered that Google Search prioritizes its own products in the top search results over other products. This work was mentioned in the antitrust hearings in July 2020, held by a U.S. congressional subcommittee.
When we interviewed Leon in April 2023 at the International Journalism Festival, he was working at The Markup, a nonprofit newsroom focused on being the watchdog of the tech industry. He has since joined Bloomberg Technology, where he's continuing his investigative work.
In addition to his articles, Leon publishes resources that explain how he worked on his investigations. Among the resources is Inspect Element, a guide he put together on how to conduct investigations into algorithms, build datasets, and more.
We were really excited to talk to Leon about his journey to becoming a data journalist. Here's the interview, edited for brevity and clarity. Are you usually working on several projects at once? How do you balance that with learning new skills?
I say that I tend to like to work on two stories at once that are long-term. If something slows down, I can move to something else, either another long-term something or something a quicker churn, just to keep moving, because it's easy to stagnate sometimes, because I think that a lot of times with these investigations, you really just need time and you need review from others and feedback. That's really important to have a great relationship with your editor so that they understand like what you're going through, but also helping you prioritize what's important, right? Because there are, you know, infinite questions you could ask during these investigations. So it's like how to best use your time.
One of your stories was mentioned during a congressional hearing. Could you walk us through how that happened? And is that an outcome you were expecting?
So the way that started was my reporting partner, Agent Jeffries, she's been reporting on Google for ages. And she had done a lot on like the featured snippet, which is kind of like the text box that's been scraped from the web and summarized something. And she's really fascinated in that. But she had this greater like kind of like moonshot story of being like, how much of Google is Google, right? And so we started talking about that. And it's like actually rather theoretical, right? To like think like, well, what is Google and how do we measure it, right? And so in this process, we kind of developed this like hypothesis-driven like checklist of like how we approach investigations, right? So first and foremost, what's the question? What's the hypothesis? How much of Google is Google? And then the question is like, how are we gonna test that? How are we gonna build the data set? So, you know, luckily Google's really easy to scrape. So we scraped the most popular searches from, I think, Google Trends. We did that for like a few months, got a few thousand popular searches, all on an Android or an iPhone X that we emulated using Selenium, which is a browser automation tool usually used to test websites. We used it to collect websites, and then we spent months trying to figure out what Google was, right? So we looked through source code, we talked to a bunch of sources in SEO, figure out what it was. Then we've developed this like very naive system where first we're like, well, if it's to google.com or YouTube, it's probably Google, right? But it got more sophisticated, it kept building and building. And so we also developed this way of actually like staining the web page and getting the real estate, because, you know, even though we could tell it was Google, we still need to measure something, right? And so we ended up finding this way to selectively create bounding boxes around different elements of the page, some that were Google and some that linked out, and we colored a specific color, then took the sum of that color divided by the total real estate of the page, and it ended up being something like 42% of the first page was all to Google, right? And so that was like a stat that we finally had about this kind of like theoretical stat that everyone kind of knows. It's like, yeah, Google self-preferences itself. It owns, you know, the bakery, it makes the bread. Like, of course, it's gonna be like, gotta check out our rolls, right? But like, to actually find that number was really powerful, right? And so we're the first, and like, I love doing that thing where there's like common knowledge, but no evidence, right? Yeah. And so we go in and fill it with that void. And so when that came out, there was also the congressional hearing about antitrust, where all of the big tech CEOs were being questioned by Congress. And in the opening remarks, I think David Cicilline, I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, brought up our work when they're questioning Google, and it was just unbelievable. We're like, oh my God, how did this happen? So sometimes our work has this impact and we have no idea it's gonna happen, or like timing happens like quite well. Like, I don't know if we like went to you know, his staff and like shared those documents. I don't know if we always do that. I don't think we did in that case. And a very similar thing happened with our investigation of Amazon, which was a logical follow-up. We're like, how can we do this with another big tech platform that self-preferences itself? So we looked at Amazon private label products with popular Amazon searches. And within days of publication, which is like pretty much a year later, these investigations take like about a year. They sent a letter to Amazon leadership being like, under oath, you said that Amazon doesn't preference its products. But this study says directly the opposite of that. Please explain, right? And so it's just amazing, like, when we pitch stories, we always think about that accountability angle, right? Like, what is the thing that's being broken? Who's being impacted, right? Like, they lied under oath and we can prove that, right? And or like, you know, a law is being broken. So like, I feel like that's the way we frame our stories often. It just so happens that that happened to be something that an executive said under oath. We didn't even know that at the time, but it happened. And so, yeah, that's some of the impact we've had.
How do you figure out if a resource-intensive story is viable?
One thing that helps me determine, me and my editor determine if a story is viable, is this kind of checklist I mentioned before. And so one of the questions off the bat is like, you know, can you test something with data? How would you get the data? How difficult it's going to be? What are you going to have to classify, categorize, right? We always end up with having to ascribe a value to data, because oftentimes the output variable that we're looking for, like what's Google, what's Amazon, it's not in a neat column, and so we have to figure out what it is. And so not only do we have to figure out what it is, we have to figure out what that data set is, what that universe is, like where do you stop, right? What's enough? What's a quick test to see if something's viable? And so I approach it as such, where like I'm always thinking about these questions. And trying to fill them out and approach my editor with as many as possible before we go fully in, right? And another thing that we do that I mentioned is we do a quick test. So it's like, what's the minimal viable analysis to prove that something is measurable, something's afoot, like if a pattern is available? Like, that's actually how my most recent story on internet disparities in the United States started, which we were trying to reproduce an academic article. And so they looked at like a ton of different internet service providers in like 9 states. And originally, I was tasked to just reproduce it. And so to do that, I was like, well, let's do one provider, one small city. Let's see what we find. And what I found was that every internet speed, first of all, they're in pockets of where fast speed were and where slow speed was, right? Which seemed kind of unfair. But also, the prices were exactly the same, despite like if you're getting fast speeds or slow speeds. And we joined census data and found that it was really skewed, like lower income people were getting less fast speeds, more slow speeds at the same price. And so that quick test not only tells you the viability, but whether you have a different story, right? And so we changed our story angle from being that like academic study, which is more of a policy story, into a consumer side story of being like, you're getting a bad deal and it's happening all across the country, right? And so that's another way. So like within this checklist of questions that we ask, we also think about like what's a quick analysis you can do to show if there's something. That's something I send to my editor and then we discuss, right? And so it's usually clear if you have a story or not. It's really clear if you have a better story or not. And it's also becomes clear if you need to kill a story, right? If you have just unanswerable questions of things that are just too uncertain.
How important is it for journalists to show their work?
I think the reason why Julia Angwin had emphasized the necessity to do that is to build trust, right? To say that like, we're not p-hacking, we're not making shit up. Like, this is the evidence, and like you can see exactly how we got to our conclusions. You can draw your own conclusions, right? And so I think there's a lot of strength into that. And I just like keep going back to just traditional journalism. It's like, if you have documents or interviews, you would host them somewhere like Muckrock or on Document Cloud, right? To be like, here's my FOIA request. Here is the information that I got from that request. Fundamentally, it's similar, where it's like, I'm making a request, not to a government agency, but to a website. Here's what I asked them for. Here's the document that they gave me. And here's what I did with that document, right? So I just see building on traditional journalism, right? Just at a scale and using a different kind of language of doing so. But I think it all kind of goes back to the fundamentals, like all good things. I think that I would love to see more newsrooms invest in this, like, you know, evidence creation of like building their own data sets to answer questions. But I have seen longer write-ups of methodologies become more popular. Consumer Reports, their investigative team does that. The Wall Street, Washington Post does that. So I'm starting to see more of a change, but it's still a rarity, right? Whereas like most of the stories that I work on, it's a necessity, right? Because we just wanted me, my reporter, my editor, and whoever we investigate all have to understand that we have this, the information down, right? And that we all know exactly what's being measured, where it comes from, our assumptions, the limitations. It's all emphatic to like and necessary to make bold claims that are accurate, rather than making bold claims that are actually unsubstantiated by your evidence, which it's not clear how you got it. It's not clear what tests you ran, right? So like, I think it's all about the details, but making them really apparent, right? Of like everything you poured into it to be like, this is solid, right? And like, we did nothing to exaggerate like what you're seeing. Like the clearest examples of disparities, of patterns are so apparent, right? And I feel like it's our job just to be like, look, if you just look, you just put your data, put the data together, follow the pattern, anyone would find the same conclusion, right? And so I think that that's really the emphasis is like, for me is like, I just really want to emphasize how we build that data set, right? And that's like a skill that I'm hoping to impart on others. Like I have a tutorial for a skill that I use a lot, which is finding undocumented APIs. So like, you know, APIs are like how servers interact with the website. And there are a lot of them that aren't like official APIs, but they still work on websites. It's like a subset of web scraping. And like almost every story I work on is thanks to finding one of those. To me, data is just another thing you have to fact check, right? But like not everyone's capable of doing that. And so like you're kind of largely responsible for it. That's why I feel like that review step is super important, just to make sure that everything's accurate, reproducible, explainable. And oftentimes too, I'll try something several different ways, right? And hopefully those ways all land on the same answer, right? It assures you're not cherry picking and it assures that you've chosen a method that's reasonable, right? Because we have these long methodologies, we can disclose that, right? To be like, we tried another categorization scheme or we tried another model and the results are interpreted very similarly, right? So, you know, because data is made public, like others could do that too, right? So that's a great strength of our work is like, be like, well, if you want to try that, you can. Like, it's right here. You can compare it to this.
How did you get to where you are today, an investigative data journalist?
I graduated from NYU with a degree in chemistry. I was working a lot in biogeochemistry, so that's like a lot of oceanography. I was doing computational kind of oceanography. And right after I graduated, I got an internship at NASA. And there I was learning a lot of what later became like data science tools. Like at the time, I didn't know what the term was. I was mostly, you know, recruited to work there to work on a database of like synthesizing data from a bunch of studies on seawater chemistry and writing like a Fortran model to process it because they use Fortran at NASA. And that's when I started learning about data science. But then I decided not to get an advanced degree in ocean sciences and I wanted to pursue data science more. So I worked at Sony as like a junior data scientist for a while. I built a lot of data pipelines. I learned about ETLs, databases. I learned about machine learning for the first time and implemented one on the job. And at the time, I started getting interested more in like how to use these tools for, you know, more impactful work. So I saw a role open up at NYU. They have, it was called SMAP at the time, but now it's called CSMAP for the Center Social Media and Politics. It's kind of the interface of like data science applied to social science problems. So I worked there as like a research scientist and engineer for a while, building a lot of open source tools, learning a lot about social science, right? Like how to design an experiment. And during that time, I got introduced to social media platforms because I'd built a lot of data pipelines and like had publications there that were working, doing research, doing that. But there are a lot of questions that were left unanswered, a lot of platforms that went unstudied. Mm-hmm. Like I was really interested in YouTube that whole time and there just wasn't a great answer for that. And so During that time, too, Julia Angwin's machine bias work came out, seminal work about recidivism algorithms. I saw her talk about it at some conference and was like, what is this? Like, this is journalism? Like, journalism can be so, like, impactful, data-oriented, so thorough. And she found the markup shortly thereafter, or like a few years after that, actually. And so, you know, I heard her pitch for it of being like, we're going to build our own data sets to hold tech accountable. I found that it would be a great outlet to pursue a lot of the questions I had and look at the platforms that were being unlooked at in my academic position. And I had the skills through all those different practices of like building data pipelines, learning how to run experiments. So it was just kind of a natural fit. It was kind of unbelievable that like a place opened up where all those skills can come together. And so I interviewed and I met Julia and we kicked it off. It's actually funny because I was being interviewed as a source for another story and other sources kept routing them to me. And so I talked to Aaron Sankin, who's my current colleague, like as a source, and he's was like, I think we're interviewing you too. And I was like, yeah, I am. So it's kind of funny because at the time I was working a lot on like memes and like, you know, image campaigns. And that was like their work on hate speech at the markup or something that they never published, but we kind of crossed there. And so yeah, I started at the markup originally as a data science editor because they wanted to use my expertise to like up our data science capacity in the newsroom. But it felt weird having a role of like editor when I hadn't worked on stories before, as you can imagine. It's like, where does authority come from? Authority comes from experience. I had no experience writing stories. However, I started working on some stories and I really loved it. And at some point, me and Julia Angwin were just like, you know, maybe I should just become a data journalist and just like, just focus on stories and just make that my main priority. And that's what I did. And I haven't looked back. It's been absolutely wonderful to work on these stories, like really kind of engraving them, like how we do show your works, which is our methodologies. I played a really heavy role doing that, having authored so many of them. And really great. So, you know, maybe I'll become an editor one day, but right now I'm having a really good time just working on stories.
Thanks for listening to the In Old News podcast. We'll be back with more soon, and in the meantime, don't miss some of our other interviews.
You can follow us at In Old News across social media platforms, or subscribe to our newsletter at inoldnews.com. Till next time.